So this morning I'm going to talk about My Stroke of Insight by Jill Taylor, and Cindy DeRitter is the one who put me on to this. So My Stroke of Insight by Jill Taylor. So Jill Taylor was a Harvard-trained neuroanatomist, brain scientist, right? Who about, I don't know, probably 12, 14 years ago, suffered a stroke. And she wasn't able to talk. She couldn't walk. She couldn't read. She couldn't write. She couldn't recall any of her life. And so the book that that she's written is about her experience, with the stroke, having the stroke, dealing with the stroke, the aftermath, recovering from the stroke. And of course, she's become quite famous in the last 12 years. She couldn't write either during the stroke. Well, not. I'm talking about during the stroke itself. During the stroke itself, she could not talk, walk, read, write, or remember anything about her previous life while the stroke was occurring. And there are many different kinds of strokes. And the stroke that she had was a stroke in which the left brain shut down, the left hemisphere shut down completely. So the left hemisphere is time, is memory, is projection into the future, is logic, is context, is ego. That stuff shut down, and she was left with right brain activity, which is intuitive, creative, empathic, and always in the now because it doesn't know anything else. Because it has no memory. And this was very disorienting for her, as you can imagine. But at the same time, it was enlightening. And I'm speaking literally, because she said, I had not read the Buddhist literature, but it was nirvana. She doesn't know what nirvana is, I don't think. But anyway, it was nirvana. She said, I felt one with everything. I felt a deep calmness and a connection to everything. And you know, nirvana in Sanskrit has two meanings. The first is to cool by blowing, and the second is to blow out. So she had bypassed the cool by blowing, which is the Zen practice part, where we're trying to just get a little coolness, just a little coolness, through all the different practices we do. And she just blew out. But she had a stroke, so what do you expect? And luckily for her, during this experience of the stroke, she had intermittent flashes of left brain ability. If she had not had those intermittent flashes, she wouldn't have known to go for help. She wouldn't have recognized that she was having a stroke. But she had those intermittent flashes, and those mobilized her to go for help, even though she was in this nirvanic state, right? So one of the main points of her book and her writing and the work that she does now is that we have this left brain and right brain complementary relationship, but usually it's not complementary relationship. It's a dominant relationship. The left brain just squeezes the right brain out, just overwhelms it, almost smothers it. And it's a question of bringing the two into balance. And she says at some point that this stroke taught her that nirvana is never more than a thought away. Oh, that's pretty wise. Never more than a thought away. When we chant the Heart Sutra, if we chant one version, without thought coverings, one realizes nirvana. Just one thought covering is the just one thin veil, one varana, one veil, one thought covering covers up just this, and the joy of just being with this as it is. And so her thesis is that we can all uncover from those the dominance of those thoughts. Of course, she doesn't tell us how to do it. I mean, you read the book and you think, we all got to have strokes, basically. Although she does give tips, she doesn't seem to know anything about meditation. If she does know about it, she chooses not to talk about it. Well, she had her pathway was a stroke, so you know, lots of different pathways, right? You never know, right? And she talks about during the experience herself that she had two strong emotions. One was grief. She grieved for the death of the woman that she had been, the woman that she carried around inside of her for all those years. She grieved for that death. And then at the same time she had tremendous relief that she didn't have to carry that burden anymore. That burden was gone, completely gone. And this is not that unusual when you have or I have or someone has an experience of just opening up to this. During an experience that I had many years ago, I was sitting with a group of people about bigger group than this, and it was like on the fifth day of a retreat, and all of a sudden I had an enlightenment stroke. I don't know. And I ran out of the meditation hall because I didn't want to upset anybody, and I could just everything was opening up. I was crying with grief for the fact that this poor fellow Tim Burkett was gone, who had been so intimate as part of this body life for so many years, and then also laughing. He was always made up in the first place. He was always a fabrication in the first place. Do you know what I mean? A little bit, do you know what I mean? A lot, do you know what I mean? So during her stroke, and as a result of her stroke, she morphed, that's my term, right? She morphed, she changed from feeling small and isolated to what? Enormous and expansive. She incapacitated her cells temporarily that deliberated about past or future, so she just felt like all these cells right now were her. All this was her, is her. Always will be her. Always will be you. Always. Because it's here. And as she was released from the restricted left hemisphere circuitry, she felt these trillions of cells. She says, I felt a part of a flow of trillions of cells of gallons of water. water. And she said it was like she wears bifocals. She's nearsighted. She said it was like taking her glasses off. It was like taking her glasses off and seeing that the edges were soft and everything. But they weren't hard. And the cadence had slowed way, 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 way down. So lately we've been talking about Dogen. He's talking about night eyes. It's eyes that see in the night. It's very much what she's talking about. Night eyes. Eyes that see in the night. And she got help. She went home. And saw a brain surgeon, and he said that she should have surgery. And she had, they found a congenital malformation in her brain, which had caused the left side to shut down, and she had surgery. Then she worked for 8 years to get the left side back, to learn how to walk, to learn how to talk, to learn how to plan for 8 years. Her goal was, she was trying to do that, she tried to only recover the emotional programs that she wanted in the left brain. This is pretty tricky. But that was her goal. I mean, she was both a neuroanatomist and had this experience, so that was her goal. And it took her 6 years of hard work. And she, by that time, she could walk and she could drive again. And then she began to be able to multitask, which is a good sign, but also a bad sign, I would say. Because what does multitasking do to the left side? It gets, charges it up. It pushes the right side down because, oh, all the things I got to do, all the things I can do, all the demands of my time. There, we've lost it. We've covered it up. It's never lost. It's never lost. We just cover it up with our thought coverings, with our veils. So in 6 years, she could climb stairs, she could drive, she could multitask. And then at the 8th year, what happened is that she began to experience herself as a solid again. A solid Jill again. A solid Jill again. And she missed the feeling of being one with all life. She missed it. But here it was coming back. So how could she ameliorate it? How could she ameliorate it? That was her goal. She really didn't want to lose her nirvanic state. Who does? Who does? She points out, as you guys know, that in Western culture, right mind is portrayed unflatteringly. Right? Unflatteringly. Maybe in most cultures. Maybe in most cultures. Because it doesn't understand verbal language or linear thought, it's not sequential, it's not methodical, can't organize. All it can do is hang out. And whereas left brain is doing all this stuff to organize and consolidate, right brain is always on vacation. It's always on vacation, right? Emptiness, always on vacation, always vacant, right? Continually on vacation. Well, how would we get anything done? Well, that's why we need left brain. Left brain is good. But somehow we got ourselves in this dilemma of letting left brain take over, letting it become the king who banishes the other side of his being. And she talks. Then she. It looks like she's read. During these years, she's read a little bit about Eastern thought. Although she's not much in here about it. But here's something that you may know about, which is interesting, on right left brain stuff that was done in Milwaukee about a few years ago. And this was done with a single photon emission computed tomography. Okay, single photon emission computed tomography, a SPECT. Brain scientists like her doing this kind of thing. So Tibetan meditators and Franciscan nuns were invited to meditate or pray inside the SPECT machine. They were instructed to tug on a cotton twine when they reached either their meditative climax or felt united with God. These experiments, well, you know, for the nuns, it's united with God, right? Whatever. <you know. laughs> These experiments identified shifts in neurological activity in very specific regions in the brain. At first, there was a decrease in the activity of the left hemisphere language centers, resulting in a silencing of their brain center. That's what this practice is about. It's learning to silence that brain center. That's why we sit here every morning in silence. That's why our retreats are totally in silent. This is the only way that you can really contact and bring to life your overlooked right side. Silence, silence, silence. Because the left side takes over so quickly, dominates so rapidly, and once it's in charge, it ain't going to let go. It ain't going to let go. So that's even when you steep yourself in silence, you say, oh, no, that's okay. That's okay. As you're saying, oh, no, there's a little space there. There's a little space there. You're being in silence. We have retreats here every month. And I would like to have more and more retreats. And, of course, I want people to follow the form in retreats. But that doesn't matter much to me, really. Doesn't matter much to me. I really only care about one thing, silence. Because if you steep in silence, if you completely steep in it, right brain will open up. Right, left brain will quiet down. It happens for everybody. If it hasn't happened for you yet, you haven't really given yourself to this practice. If you really give yourself to this practice, I don't care if you've been practicing a month or 30 years. Give yourself to it. Just for a year, just 1 year. If you give yourself totally for 1 year and steep yourself in silence every day and do retreats here or someplace else, go to a nunnery and do retreats. I don't care. But don't read. Don't read. Don't read the Bible. Don't read the Heart Sutra. Steep yourself in silence. If you do that, I give you a guarantee. Just as my teacher did me, I give you a guarantee. You will know this wonder that's always here. You will realize it's never been far from you. It's only a thought covering away. It's a thin veil. It's so thin, you guys. But you put one veil on top of the other, one thought covering on top of the other, and so it feels so heavy. You've got a million veils, a million of these weightless thought coverings, and they seem so weighty. They feel so weighty. First, there was a decrease in the activity of the left hemisphere language centers, resulting in a silencing of their brain chatter. Second, there was a decrease in activity in the orientation association area, located in the posterior... trouble with these pronunciation here. The posterior parietal gyrus of the left hemisphere. Parietal. Thank you. Have you? Well, I was too, but I can't pronounce it. I probably just learned it to take the psych examination and then never thought about it again. This region of our left brain helps us identify our personal physical boundaries. This is what the researchers were saying. She's quoting from the research. When this area is inhibited or displays decreased input from our sensory systems, we lose sight of where we begin and where we end relative to the space around us. And then you are beginningless. You are endless. This is not something someone made up. You are. You are beginningless and endless. You are. So she talks, Jill talks, about how the right side and the left side process information differently. She says they have different value systems. Well, that's kind of laying a lot on these little hemispheres, isn't it? So they have different value systems, even different personalities. And, of course, we need the cognitive flexibility of the right and the concrete planning, organizing ability of the left. And the right hemisphere bounces around with unbridled enthusiasm. Unbridled enthusiasm. It smiles. It's always smiling. Even if the world ends, the right brain smiles. It's pretty stupid. It smiles. World's always ending anyway. Might as well smile. It's friendly. It's friendly. Not the left brain. The left brain knows it's a scary world out there, you guys. Shit's happening out there. Got to protect yourself. Clenches the jaw, frowns. The left brain, ideally, takes all the energy of the present moment and the great possibility and the wonder of the right brain and shapes it into something manageable. That's what we're going for here. But you can't go for it if you don't experience the right brain. And you can't experience the right brain unless you steep yourself in silence. Or unless you have a stroke, okay. Have a stroke or steep yourself in silence. But the problem with having a stroke is you've got to have just the right kind of stroke. As she pointed out, a lot of people are really weird after they have strokes. She lucked out. She had just the right kind of stroke. Some people have strokes are very moody. Very moody. They don't get any, and they don't get any left brain back at all. And then you have to be cared for the rest of their lives. So I don't think that's a good way to go. I wouldn't recommend that. So the left brain can shape, can organize, can form the immediate right brain activity to communicate, to organize, to identify patterns, to live in the world. And the left brain... No, the right, I get mixed up about this, the right brain, the right brain perceives longer wavelengths of light, long wavelengths of light. So its perceptions are softened and blended because long wavelengths soften and blend perceptions, soften edges. This lack of hardness in edges helps us focus on the big picture. And together with these longer wavelengths, the right brain perceives basically low-frequency sound. Low-frequency sound. Gurgles, All kinds of bodily sounds, natural tones. So if you really meditate, if you really steep yourself in silence, you'll have some experience of this after you've been steeping yourself for a while. When I was younger and meditated in my hometown of San Francisco, our Zen center was faced Bush Street in San Francisco. And Bush Street is a one-way street that heads for downtown. It heads from, so it's a one-way street full of cars going downtown. And we would sit in the morning at whatever time we sat, probably the same time we do here, 5:45. And we would get out, we'd go downstairs, and I'd open the door to the outside at maybe 7:15, rush hour, 7:20. And the cars would be just streaming by, streaming by, and the sound of the car, and all the traffic and the clutter and the everything. And when my meditation was good, I would just be enthralled by the sounds, just enthralled. I'd open the door and I'd just sit on the step. And my friends would say, "Oh, Tim, let's get out of this noise and go down to the bay." And I'd say, "I don't want to get out of this noise. It's wonderful. You go down to the bay." And I, because this deep silence is everywhere. It's everywhere. Right in the middle of your worst chaotic moment, it's completely still. When, because your long light waves perceive low frequency, which is everything. Everything. And then you have your short light waves. And your short light waves are precipitated by the left brain. And they, short light waves, you need to delineate sharp boundaries between me and you, between me and this, so that I can walk, so that I can plan. And they're very adept at that. And they're also very adept at hearing language, because language is in a high frequency, whereas natural noise is low frequency, according to Jill. This is my introduction to brain physiology. I had years of psychology, but I never did a thing on brain physiology, except when I studied for the psych licensing test, and I crammed. So that's kind of the way this goes. Jill's goal during her reentry phase was to recover her left brain capability and to recover its genius. The left brain has a genius of being able to consolidate from small bits of organization and create stories. But at the same time, it stirs up drama and trauma. So her goal was to try to do one and not the other. But nobody ever taught her how to meditate. I'll teach her. I'll teach her. That's what I'm here for. Invite her over. I don't think she'd come over here. I heard she was on Oprah recently, so I think she's gone way beyond us. And she talks about the fact that the limbic system, that it takes less than 90 seconds for the limbic system program to be triggered. So say, something happens to make me angry. I don't know what would happen. Something happens to make me angry. Okay, from the time that the incident occurs to the time that it passes through my system, I have a feeling of anger and a tightening of my jaw, quickening of my breath, to the time that it dissipates in the bloodstream is 90 seconds. It's 90 seconds. And she says that it's important to honor that 90 seconds. And if we honor that 90 seconds, it's all cool. But the problem is that that one circuit then creates, with left brain dominance, another circuit and another circuit and another circuit. Whereas because I'm talking to myself about what Ben did to make me angry. I don't know what Ben could have done.
Oh, I could think of something.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I talk about it. And I talk about how not only did he do that, but Linda did something to me this morning, and my cat did something else to me, and then the talking. It's only 90 seconds, and we can stop it at that point. We can stop it by just coming back to this. So she talks about that we have a choice, and of course it's true we have a choice, but I don't see, if you don't settle down through meditation, I don't see how you really have that choice. But she has a choice because she had the stroke, right? Because she had the experiential awareness through the stroke. I don't think you have that. I don't think you can really have that choice unless you have a little bit of experiential awareness in your meditation. It doesn't have to be big. And of course, that's what Zen meditation is all about. Bare attention to whatever happens so that the circuit can play out. It's 90 seconds. Dissolve in the bloodstream. It only takes 90 seconds to completely dissipate, and then you're A-okay, just as you are. So then she talks about her practices, the practices that she does. And one practice that she does is she says to herself, perfect moment. Well, you'd think she'd read Thich Nhat Hanh, but she doesn't. Says she doesn't know anything about Buddhism or anything about that. Well, that's from a Thich Nhat Hanh book. I don't know if she realizes that. Although Thich Nhat Hanh on the in-breath says, what does he say? Present moment on the in-breath, perfect moment on the out-breath. Present moment on the in-breath, perfect moment on the out-breath. So she talks about how sometimes she has to say to herself 100 times, perfect moment, to come back to just relaxing in right brain, just relaxing in here, in being here. but she generally tries to wait her 90 seconds first, being a good brain scientist at all. Interesting. Interesting. We'll have to try it, huh? Waiting 90 seconds. And the things that she does. She says, sometimes she talks to herself. She does counter talk. So all of these are what we might call voice busting exercises, right? Internal dialogue busting exercises. She says, one thing she says when her circuits seem out of control, her anger circuit, she says, I appreciate your ability to think thoughts and feel emotions, but I am really not interested in thinking these thoughts or feeling these emotions anymore. Can you imagine that? It's sure not the way I'd do it, but she does that. Then sometimes she says, I say, cancel, cancel. Well, that's a pretty good gotcha, isn't it? Cancel, cancel. And she says, sometimes I say, enough, enough. Well, that's cool. That's cool. I mean, we've been practicing here for the last year or so, bringing positive mental dharmas into view, working with gathas, working with mantras. Well, she's got hers. Those are sacred, just as sacred as anything, because they come from her own experience, her own psyche. In my own gathas over the years, I haven't talked too much about them, but when I was preparing for this, I thought, oh, I'll talk a little bit about those. So I don't remember what I used to do. That is, I've been practicing for so many years, but the last 12 years, these are the three things I've been saying to myself generally. When I begin to see, when I begin to feel, oops, there goes left brain, there goes Tim, telling one of those stories again, complaining again, putting himself down again, whatever, there he goes. Right? So, three things I do. One thing, I say to myself, Amma, 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 Amma. Now, this is purely because of my own experience. This is purely because 12, 13, 14 years ago, I was at a meditation retreat with Amachi, the great Indian sage. And I'd been at a retreat. I'd been steeping myself in silence for 3 days. And I went back to the motel room and sat down and looked at the bedspread. And left brain just clicked off entirely. And the bedspread was the whole universe. And Tim was gone again. Gone again. Gone again. These fellows and girls, they'll always come back, but they're only here temporarily. You guys, don't treat them as boarders. They're just guests. If you treat them as guests, they'll go on their way. They will. But you treat them as boarders. You think you have to take care of them and nurture them. They're only guests. Give them a cup of tea. Send them on their way. So Tim went on his way. Great beauty, great wonder, great stillness, great timelessness. Always, always present. Always present. And that was after I'd been with Amma. Amma. Amma means mother in Hindi, in Sanskrit. Amachi, mother. It also means great emptiness, great spaciousness. So sometimes I say Amma to myself. Amma, 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 Amma. But that's just my thing based on my experience. It's my sacred mantra. It's the sacred mantra. The only sacred mantra. Practice my sacred mantra and you will da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Right? Be careful of that stuff, you guys. Be careful of it. Really. It's got just the right vibrations cultivated for 2,500 years. How about my second one? Et cetera, et cetera. It's just 3,000 years of great cultivation, English language, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I say to myself. I know after I say something once or twice, then I go into et cetera, just to remind myself, just to stop, just to come back to this, just to this, this wonder, this joy that is not of Tim, that is not of Susan, that is not of Cal, and yet is us, continually. What's the third thing I do? Oh, I know the third thing I do. This is when I put myself down. This is when I see those old tapes of, you didn't do good enough. How did you screw that one up? You're no da-da. I say, good boy. Good boy. Good boy. And then if it's still Tim going, I say, good boy, Tim. Good boy. Those are my three sacred mantras. Yes. Yes, right. He patted himself on the head. It's good to have a kinesiology, a kinesiological response to go with it. I recommend it. Pat yourself on the head.
Yada, yada, yada works too.
Okay. All right. All right.
Seinfeld.
Pardon?
Seinfeld.
Oh, yeah, right, right, right. Yada, yada, yada. Well. So she calls all this work that she's doing now tending the garden of her mind so that she can just keep some life in her right brain and not just cover it up with left brain stuff. And then she also does something in extreme situations which I have never tried, and I don't necessarily recommend it, but you can try it. She says in extreme situations, that is when her right brain is just complaining and feeling and depressing and discouraging and all over the place, she says to itself, oh, okay, you can have 30 minutes of wine time. 30 minutes of wine time in the morning, 30 minutes of wine time at night, and then she just reminds her cells that during the day, if they start whining, oh, you're going to have your 30 minutes tonight. She says, she does it. And then if her wine time doesn't even work, she does these three things. She thinks about something that brings her great joy. She remembers something she found fascinating. Or she thinks about something she would like to do. Not exactly brain science, is it?
Yeah.
But pretty good. Pretty good advice. Pretty good advice. She talks also about brain circuits and how we have hundreds of brain circuits that are in process all the time. And that each memory is tied to a different circuit. And that each thinking circuit is generally related to an emotional circuit, and that emotional circuit is related to a physiological circuit. No wonder poor right brain gets left out with all that activity going. So she gives an example. And this is a reverse example of the skandhas, but this is in terms of order. So she has a dog. She's never been married. She has a dog. She thinks about her dog. She has a dog she loves. Her dog is her partner in life. We have different partners in life. So she has a dog. She thinks about her dog, and that's the thinking circuit. Then she feels joy when she thinks about her dog. That's the emotional circuit. And then the physiological circuit kicks in. She gets excited. Her voice gets childlike. Her eyes dilate. And she says she even wags her body. I have to see that. Imagine that. And then if her dog was, if she thinks about her dog dying, she has a thinking circuit, and she had the sadness circuit, then she has the physiological circuit, eyes welling up, chest tightening, shallow breathing. But her point again is, and it's been such an important point in our 2,300 years of Buddhist teaching, that you honor your circuits. You honor them. And that's the way to let go of them. Talking about them isn't honoring them. You honor them and then you let go of them. As Dogen would say, you're intimate with them. And that's how you let go of them. Even if it seems like there's a multiplicity of them and they're out of control. She also says that she thanks herself every morning and asks them to heal her. Oh, that's cool. That's cool. So that's what she's talking about. That's what we do here without a stroke. This is our practice. This is what we do here every day and in our retreats and at home when we practice. Our steeping in silence, we don't have to just do. We can do many, many different meditative approaches to steep ourselves in silence. In this, we're doing practice period here in the fall. It's an 8-week practice period, and we started with the Satipatthana Sutta, in which we work with a breath, we work with a body. The other night we were working with sensations, just noting sensation, just noting pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Not our thoughts about sensations. It's so easy that left brain sort of takes over right brain to such a degree that we don't even realize it's taken over. And we're practicing the simple practice of the Vedana practice of paying attention to pleasant, unpleasant, neutral sensations. And instead, you're thinking, you're remembering pleasant, unpleasant, neutral sensations. So we do that. And when we sit in retreat, we sit straight, because by keeping our spine straight, it encourages right brain activity. But we can sit in chairs. We can sit on the floor. We can do slow walking meditation. I think slow walking meditation is just as good as sitting, for if it's really slow, for slowing the mind down. So we can do many, many different things. And we've been practicing also the labeling, Vipassana labeling. Some people can do that, and that can be very helpful, where you're labeling. You're saying to yourself, remembering, planning. And that way, you're using left brain to slow left brain down to access right brain. The catch-22 of that is what? That it's still a left brain activity, and sometimes then left brain gets more active as a result. I'm not really planning here. What's this planning entailing? Am I doing it right? And so the practice, the way you do this, should be, you should marry it to your own psyche, to your own psychic need. You should marry it and not try to just follow, I don't think, some right form. The right form is your form. You are fluid. By nature, you are completely fluid. And your fluidity includes everything. So I want to finish by reading a couple stories. So I'll read a right brain story, and then I'll read a complementary right and left brain story. Okay, the right brain story. Ramana Maharshi, one of the teachers, so he's been dead for years, but I've always felt he was a teacher of mine. Started reading when I was about 20. When Ramana Maharshi lay dying, the cries of his devotees' grief reached his ears. He asked one of his attendants, "Why do they despair so deeply?" His attendant answered, "It's because you are leaving them, Master." Ramana turned to his attendant in puzzlement. "But where do they think I could go? Where do they think I could go? Is there any place to go? Is there any place to go?" That's right brain. No, right brain, left brain compliment. Let's see. There's a story of the Tibetan teacher Marpa, who lived on a farm with his family 1,000 years ago in Tibet. On the farm, there also lived many monks who came to study with this great teacher. One day, Marpa's oldest son was killed. Marpa was grieving deeply when one of the monks came to him and said, "I don't understand. You teach us that all is an illusion, yet you are crying. If all is an illusion, then why do you grieve so deeply?" Marpa replied, "Indeed, everything is an illusion, and the death of a child is the greatest of these illusions." So I think I'll turn it over to you now to see if you have questions or comments. Want to emit low-frequency sounds? You can do that if you'd like. Go ahead. Actually, she got the...
It was a TED Talk. So, but what I think I'll do is see if I can get Kim the link so you can see her directly. She's really good.
There's also a quote from a Zen teacher named Brad Warren that I like. That's about...
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Bill.
Yeah, I always heard news about the hunter-gatherers and agricultural at least in popular psychology, the left brain can kind of be surmised as in its villain form as the word should. You know, instead of the should, so that you're always sort of degraded. I mean, they're written poorly about psychology, but that constant domination of should. And, you know, I've sort of wondered about that. I'm thinking that once the shift happened from hunter-gatherer to agricultural, that should became so important, that whole domination of once you started putting your life on the seasons in such a way of what was necessary for crop production and how much incredible work that there was to do so that you could survive. And then the irony is that it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution that the caloric intake of human beings actually reached the level of hunter-gatherer.
Reached the level of hunter-gatherers?
Yeah, that caloric intake of hunter-gatherer people was higher than agricultural people, and it didn't reached until the Industrial Revolution.
Yes.
So the should just got stronger and stronger, and you couldn't back out of what you were doing.
Oh, that's a good point.
You had to commit population or something. So it's this left brain. So I always wonder, well, with a hunter-gatherer, I mean, I'm sure there's papers on that.
Hunter-gatherers
to explore, to investigate. I mean, when you think of the story of Adam and Eve, it's like she was a hunter-gatherer. She was, you know, she took the apple to eat it. And that was the great should was you should.
Yes, that's right.
So you should not go back.
That's right. That's right. Yep. Good. Thank you. Yes.
I'm Carla.
Hi.
I work a lot with Alzheimer's. I wonder how that, the right brain, what just happened with them and that.
Do you have any idea?
I just imagine that they're more in the right brain.
You would think so. But there's an awful lot of left brain activity in people with Alzheimer's, because there's a lot of narrative going on there. There's a lot of storytelling. The stories are fragmented; they don't fit together. But you work more closely with them, people with Alzheimer's, than I do. But my experience is there's a lot of storytelling, but it's lost its cohesiveness. It's lost its ability to organize. It's like left brain activity, which has lost its capacity to do what left brain activity is supposed to do, which is plan, organize, consolidate. That's what I think. But I'm sure there's some right brain in there stuff, if the right brain in there too. I don't know. I haven't. Other people. Susan.
And when you were talking, I thought, if I could enter a right brain place with her, I'd have a wonderful time.
Really?
I played. That's how I was with her. I put on Frank Sinatra, the old music that she loved.
Yeah.
And she, most of the time, seems to be just out of it and asleep and depressed and doesn't say much or do much. But she was singing along. And then she wanted to stay with me in that place of play for the rest of the day. So my sister came home and we started talking and it got all left brain. My mother just retreated. Very frustrated.
Interesting.
It was very interesting.
Manoj. Yes.
And one of them is memory. It talks about people with no long-term memory.
Yes.
Only have short-term memory.
Yes.
Sort of like memento. And he also asked this question about, you know, this whole notion of, you know, self. And, you know, so he talks about people who have strokes which take out the sense of the self.
Uh-huh.
So they sort of have no... I mean, it's connected to the short-term memory.
Uh-huh.
One question I had is, is she talking about... She's not recommending clearly to blow away her left side, right?
No. I mean, she spends 8 years trying to recover her left side. Now she's working as a brain scientist again, right. But she spent like 10 years, really.
So, I'm a bit confused as to what is she trying. So when she says when the left gets stuck, so it's that balance the sides. Is that
so they can work in a complementary whole, so that yin and yang can be as they are meant to be, which is one whole. And one fluid whole. But if there's no experience of yin, if there's no experience of the darkness, yang tends to just dominate. So to have the wholeness of yin-yang, you have to know yin. You have to know complete darkness. And of course, in meditation, you're not likely to get lost. You're not likely just to be totally... Your memory could be affected. I'm sorry to say that, but my teacher and I, not Katagiri Roshi, but Suki Roshi and I, our memories have really been affected by this practice. But, you can't have everything. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Robert Aiken said that too when I came to meet him, so years ago. Pardon? What'd you say? As I recall. Well, what? Well, when you lose all that emotional memory that you're always hanging out with, emotional memory is what keeps the memories alive from the past, and when those emotions dissipate. Sometimes the cognitive stuff from the past goes along with it because it's the emotional stuff that keeps the cognitive stuff sort of well in your psyche. So absent-mindedness. Suzuki Roshi was incredibly absent-minded. I'm kind of absent-minded, but not like him. Not like him. Maybe I am. Maybe my wife would think I'm as bad. And the irony is that Buddhism is all about mindfulness. Well, okay, all right. All right, I don't know what to say about that. Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of what you might call untended or artificial enlightenment, I heard a story about Suzuki Roshi and a kid at the Zen Center. It may be apocryphal, but you may know if it's true. That, during the height of the hype, some kid, tripping his brains out, walked in, sat down, and then went up and rang the bell and walked out of the hall. Suzuki followed him and saw that his pupils were dilated and twitchy. And he said, "Yes, but will it last?"
That sounds like a good story. I mean, I haven't heard that before. Suzuki Roshi, when I was with him and I was young, there would be a lot of people. I mean, this was San Francisco. San Francisco in 1965, 1966, 1967. And so, people were always wafting over and their odors and their presence. And they would come through. And he talked about, and so everybody would be talking to him about LSD, basically. And he referred to it as dry enlightenment. He said, "That's dry enlightenment." He said, "Dry enlightenment is an experience that you have, but it doesn't really wet you so that you can be supportive of all beings." That was his. So that sounds like something he could have said. Uh-huh. Anything else?
When you say absent-mindedness...
What?
When you say absent-mindedness, because you said it's about mindfulness.
Yeah.
But, I'm young, so I don't have a lot of absent-mindedness. Is it complete blank, or is it mindful?
Well, one problem of being in the moment is that you forget the last moment.
But that's
your wife doesn't like it. I mean, really. And she has a right not to like it. Or your husband doesn't like it. Do you understand? So that's something I need to work more. Pardon?
When you forget the milk and butter because you're in the moment at the grocery store.
Exactly. So I've been working for many years to compensate. Without having had a stroke. Keep my zazen going, but try to do a left brain things to keep. And now that I'm getting old, you know, I really have to do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Yeah, but I was struck because you started your talk about balance.
Yes.
And yet I found myself like, well, I right brain, that's very, I mean, a good.
Yes.
Kind of thing.
Yes. Yeah, I completely agree. Could you guys hear what he said? I completely agree. I couldn't agree more. But we have to, as a Zen teacher, I have to emphasize, I feel like I need to emphasize right brain. Because if you don't get a taste of right brain, there will never be any complementarity. It will just be left brain dominance for your whole life, and your life will be gone. You will have just been in the past and the future, except maybe once in a while when you see a sunset or have an orgasm or something. And that's not a way to live. Jeez. I feel sad about that. So many people live that way. Do you understand? Yeah.
Also, in a lot of ways, now Western culture, decorum.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I think therefore I am.
Yes.
I'm so in love with.
Yes.
And a lot of good has come out of it. But
yes.
We've also lost a lot, including a lot of our creative capacity and potential.
That's right.
We need every bit of the time that we
That's right. Thank you. Thank you. Very good. Okay. I want to thank you.